Hi, I'm Nigel Parker. I've just finished delivering this Microsoft Unplug session around New Zealand, and I'm going to re-deliver it here online for you. The session's titled Getting Ready for Cloud-Based Services, IE8 and Silverlight 2, and it's intended as a precursor for the Professional Developers Conference that's taking place later this month in LA. I start the session with quite a high-level overview of what I mean by cloud-based services. Now, this material I've adopted from a colleague of mine, Miha, who's an architect up at Microsoft in Redmond, who's recently done a session on the future of IT. Following on from that, I move into some more practical examples where I show some highlights of Silverlight and also Internet Explorer 8. So let's get started. The future isn't what it used to be. What I mean by this is very often when we think about the future, we think about the Jetsons and flying cars and a far-reaching future which is completely different to the present that we're living in. But really what I wanted to do with this session was pitch this conversation at a place where the future is really a logical extension of the present and the things that we're working with now. I like the quote from William Gibson maybe 5 years ago, where he said that the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. If you have a look at the picture in the top left-hand corner here, this is the crystal ball from The Wizard of Oz. Down in the bottom right is actually the Microsoft Surface Sphere, which is also a crystal ball, but has a multi-touch interface, video conferencing, and can manipulate information like here it's working with Virtual Earth as a globe. Now this technology exists, it's just not widely distributed. So it means that people are able to get hold of it in research labs, but not necessarily in their day-to-day lives. Moving on from that, technology has the power to alter reality. What I mean by this, I've got a 2.5-year-old daughter, and my daughter, she watches TV on a computer, and she watches a computer via the TV. So to her, there's no difference between the word TV or the word computer, because she's growing up with a convergence between these specific technologies. If you think about yourselves growing up at school or you know leaving university or that stage of life, we didn't have access to cell phones. So therefore, if we needed to meet up with our friends in an evening location, we had to pre-arrange that. We couldn't text message or call them to find out where they were at a specific point in time. So this technology is now second nature to us, but it's hard to remember what it was like before that technology actually existed. And moving on from the theme from The Matrix, taking the red pill or the blue pill, once you've actually changed and you start to adopt new technology, would you go back? Would you actually turn around and go back to what it was like before you had access to these things, be it a cell phone, portable music players, you know, whatever the technology is that you're thinking of? If you have a look at the traditional business models, there's four buckets here, so future, emerging, wide application, and obsolete. Anybody who's using a VHS recorder to record TV today is probably falling into this area of obsolete technology. It used to be widely adopted, but it's just something that people don't tend to do as often anymore. And if you follow the traditional business model, it's a model that has cost and risk closely attached to each other. And it's this whole wait until service pack one model where you actually don't buy or invest in a new technology until it reaches that area of wide adoption. The alternative model, and this is one that say the Generation Y or digital natives are actually bringing into the workplace. And this is a model where a technology comes from an area of future into an area of emerging, and it's instantly available and it instantly adds value to your business. So an example of this is Microsoft ICE. Microsoft ICE is straight out of our research labs. It stands for Image Composition Editor, and it takes a lot of different photos and it stitches them together and produces an output in a high definition format. Now this technology has only been available for a matter of weeks, but it's something that I picked up and have actually been using quite often as a way to solve a problem that I didn't have a solution for previously. That said, with this new model, it's very possible that inside your organization, you could actually pick up a new service or a new technology, and you could run with it, and you could have it adopted the next day, sometimes without cost, and quickly leapfrogged your competition. So when you're thinking about these things, and you're thinking about the rest of the presentation that I'm going to give here, think about this new curve and how it differs to the traditional business curve. So next we ask ourselves the question of where did all the vendors go? If you think back to 1997, I was at university with some mates and we were starting up a web hosting company here in Auckland called WebDrive. And when we were setting up our servers, it was very much piecewise. We'd buy a couple of boxes and it would have all the peripherals that were associated with it, the keyboards, the mice, these sort of things. And we would actually be purchasing those and putting them in a room and setting up our server environments on them before offsetting them to a third-party data center. If you come forward a decade, you'll notice how the numbers of vendors are decreasing rapidly to the point that in 2008, there is only six companies that sell server technology that have more than 1% market share. So we've gone from these 25 vendors in 97 to these six vendors in 2008. And only a few years ago, I mean, you could buy servers by a rack. Instead of buying them one by one, you'd buy a whole rack of servers. And that would become the way that you could purchase and configure and put these into your data center. So what is driving all of the vendors to consolidate and to reduce to the small pool of companies? Well, the fact is that the buyers are consolidating too. If we have a look at 2008, more than a third of the world's servers have been purchased by just three companies. So Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft have purchased a third of the world's servers this year. And when you think about how or why we're purchasing these, we're not purchasing them using traditional means. We're buying them like this. So this is the HP pod, and it has 10,000 servers contained inside of it. And I bet you if you had a look inside, it would look nothing like a server room that you see today. There'd be a power supply in one corner, and it would be all componentized devices or computer components making up the servers in the most power efficient and space efficient way. If you have a look on the left-hand side here, if I just zoom in here, there's three inputs into this thing, so one, two, three. So the inputs that you get are power, cooling, and fiber connection for data. And what's more, it comes as a shipping container so it can be delivered to wherever you want it to be in the world. And once it's delivered, you don't actually get a key. You never get to look inside of this thing. So an HP technician will only come out if more than 50 servers fail. So this is actually a changing game and a changing way of thinking about data centers and server technology. And it is something that is happening quite broadly as a change in our industry. So where should these things be located? Well, this here is a picture of Iceland. And I know Iceland's having all its trouble at the moment with the World Banks and its banking infrastructure and systems. But aside from that, it's perfectly located for the next generation data centers. If you have a look at it here, it's in a cold and remote environment, so cooling being the biggest cost in any data center. It's remote, so that the security aspect of the environment is maintained. And if you have a look here, Iceland is exactly halfway between the US and Europe on the only fiber connection between those locations. So these are all compelling reasons as to why Iceland makes sense as a home for next generation data centers. If you think about New Zealand in contrast, we're also cold and we're also remote, but the connectivity outside of the country is the thing that's holding us back right now. if we had greater connectivity to Asia, which is our next largest market for GDP, we would actually position ourselves very nicely in the future in relation to this location-based data centers and cloud service. I was reading a stat that says that more English graduates come out of China each year than come out of the US and London and the UK put together. So it's not just speaking English, it's actually being masters of the English language, which will set the Chinese up very nicely for the next generation of internet technologies. So touching on from that, we talk a little bit about power. The question is, where does all the power go? If you look down the bottom of this graph here, very little amounts of the energy, the power, is actually controlled once you're inside the server or getting into the silicon on the chips. The majority of the power is actually consumed and also lost from generation to actually get through the grid to the data center itself. And then once inside the data center, cooling the data center is a massive cost that is also very lossy. If you have a look at an example of Microsoft's Quincy data center in the US, we actually saved about 3% power for cleaning the roof and reducing the clog inside of our air conditioning systems. So this is really where we're heading in relation to power. I was seeing a stat in New Zealand that said power prices in New Zealand have doubled in the last 5 years. Now some of this is because of legislation and controls, but other parts of that is related to the fact that there is a large demand on the supply that we have. I know HP, when they built their data center recently in India, right next to it, they also built a power station. And the power station was intended to serve clean and efficient power to their data center. So this is a great example of vendors reinventing themselves and becoming more attuned to reducing the largest costs in generation of these next kind of data center technologies. So what I wanted to do here was actually touch on some of the nephological myths that relate to cloud computing. I know cloud computing is just one of the buzzwords that is being bandied around at the moment, like green IT and previously things like Web 2.0 and SOA. So what I wanted to do was actually share a view of what I think cloud computing is and what it isn't. So the first one is that there's a perception out there that cloud computing is an architecture or an infrastructure, and this just isn't true. It's much, much more than that. There's also a perception that every vendor will have a different cloud. When you think about what we've been talking about here in relation to scale, we're talking about billions of dollars invested into building these data centers to serve this next generation infrastructure and design. So I think it's very realistic to say that a vendor who exists today, whether they're a hosting provider or an ISP, could in the future look at different cloud vendors, which I don't think there'll be very many of them, and actually take a view of reselling those services in a way to best suit their customers. So that's what I think when you say maybe a GoDaddy up in the US could actually be leveraging cloud computing infrastructure from another vendor to offer their hosting services in the future. Software as a service is the cloud. Now I don't think this is true. If you think here in New Zealand, Xero is a great example of a software application running through the browser. Salesforce.com is another example. I think these are services and these are great applications that could leverage cloud computing, but they're not what we're talking about when we talk about cloud computing as a whole. Cloud computing is a brand new revolution? Not true either. If you think back to the 70s, IBM and mainframe computing was all about building this huge infrastructure. Whereas today, this is the next phase of this, which is actually much grander and much larger in scale. And it's all based on locations of physical servers or virtual servers. All remote computing is cloud computing. No, I don't think so. The concept of actually having a server and having it inside your premise and then have another box over in a hosting environment and then maybe another server up in the US and California to replicate a bit of US traffic. I think this is server relocation or server location outputting, but it's definitely not what we're talking about when we're talking about cloud computing. The internet and the web are the cloud? Nope. These are services that could leverage the cloud or run on top of it, but they are different services altogether. And that everything will be in the cloud. Now, I don't think this is true either. I think there's a balance between what infrastructure exists on your premise and what infrastructure is existing out in some sort of cloud-based service. So moving on from this, I don't know who discovered water, but I'm sure it wasn't fish. What I mean by this is, as Microsoft, Google, Amazon, potentially Yahoo, all come and develop our cloud platforms, we're all developing them with ease of use in mind and thinking about scalability and distribution. But your best place to look at all the different offerings, look at what's actually out there and available, and say, well, how do I use these things to progress and bring forward my business? So what I'm meaning here is the next day or the day that this stuff becomes available and is leveraged for you, you need to think about how do I make best the solutions and how do I leverage them to serve my customers and to actually extend my product. So right now we're very worried about some of the basics that actually put these infrastructures together. Now once these problems are solved, this stuff will be irrelevant. We won't even think about it anymore. But right now, because it's still in the early days, we're actually worried about the details. I like to think when I was back at university learning about TCP/IP, which was the infrastructure that sits under the internet, or OSI as a programming or an implementation model, I really was interested in each of the different steps. But if you think about plugging a device into a power socket, you don't really care about how the power is generated, how it gets down the line, and how it gets to you. You just need to know that it's there and need to know what it's going to cost to use. And I think cloud computing is going to be very similar. Right now, we're worried about how to virtualize, how to provision new servers, and how to secure them. But once this is solved, it's going to be somewhat irrelevant in the future. The next thing is we're thinking about delivery models. So software as a service, as I mentioned before, real-time infrastructure. Think about a scenario where you've got a data pipe which is so large and so abundant that you could have an application that's serving customers all around the world, and then suddenly some customers pop up in Korea that you weren't expecting to see there. And you could take a virtual image of your server environment, you could send it over the internet to Korea, and you could bring that instance up and start serving customers using your virtual server inside their Korean environment. And then if the demand increases, you could just replicate more and more servers to meet the demand. And then you could pull that infrastructure down and have it disappear when the demand stops occurring on your application. So this is very similar to thinking about a proxy server doing local caching, but it's really about doing it with entire servers or entire infrastructure environments that used to or traditionally have taken hours or days to build and have a physical location. So thinking about core services, if you look out at the internet today and you say, well, what is running on cloud computing out there right now? A big example is search, whether it's Google search, Live search, Yahoo search. This is a great example of a service that actually runs on top of a cloud platform. Another one is payment systems and computing, offloading computing power to a third party to perform calculations and bring back the answer. And then, of course, the largest of all is storage. If you think about Amazon's S3 service, they've just recently announced, I think it was last week, that due to unprecedented growth, we're talking about 9 million extra page views this year, 9 billion extra stored objects this year, they're now re-evaluating their pricing system to actually reduce the cost of storage to get more people using the system on a scale model in face of upcoming and new competition. But then again, all of this stuff, I still think it's going to be less relevant in the future. And we are going to look and turn to the original models of consumer services. So what is this going to add to your customers? How is it going to make a better user experience? And if you look at pulling all these things together, this is where you actually make the money. This is where you take revenue and add it and get competitive advantage. So I think it's these consumer services that are really going to make the difference. So just last week, there was quite a lot of press around Steve Ballmer talking about cloud computing in preparation for the upcoming PDC announcements. And he made quite a few comments, but the comment that I was most interested in was this one here that said, cloud computing will be dictated by the interests and degree to which you capture the imagination of the developers. Now, I absolutely agree with this. Because if you think about it, if we go and build a big platform and we build a platform that is or not useful for developers, then we're wasting our time. It's more about how easy is it to adopt, in which case how easy is it to leave, and how useful is it and cost effective for you to actually leverage and build out your own solutions. So if you look at Microsoft right now today, if you do a search online and you look and see what we're doing in relation to cloud computing, you'll find a few building block services. Now, expect this story to come together and to be clearer once we announce and show a little bit more at the PDC, the Professional Developers Conference. There is a broader strategy than just these building block services, but these are the services that you can experiment with and try out and find today. So on one side of the spectrum, we have SQL Server Data Services. If you think about this, it's an extension of your database system that could be driving your in-house enterprise apps or your websites and pushing these out into a cloud-based server stored on another platform. So the scenario here is that you could be serving customers on your database and demand increases because you get put onto Slashdot or you get some sort of promotion that pushes the demand through the roof. All of a sudden you're in a position where you can't really service the customers anymore. The database can't take any more socket connections. So traditionally what you would do is serve an error page to your customers saying underload, can't serve anymore, sorry about that. But with SQL Server Data Services, what you could do is you could offload that additional database requests into a service based on a cloud platform, and then you could serve those requests from there, and once the demand reduced again, you could actually take that workload and take it back in-house into your own supply. And really it's about actually having that back door of scalable infrastructure that you don't need to pay for all the time, but during peak demand you can definitely offload into. The other one here is BizTalk Services. If you look at BizTalk Services, it's all about workflow and a workflow engine inside of the cloud. So a lot of people work between business to business or long-running transaction between suppliers and customers. This is the sort of service you could look at as an extension of that local workflow stuff that you might be working with. And then over here, the Live platform, this is our consumer platform with instant messaging and Hotmail and all of these other things. Now we've been working pretty hard on building an API at dev.live.com for a lot of these services. These are also coming into the party as part of the cloud computing platform. So if you go to mesh.com today, there's a technology preview of our service, which is really just a consumer service running on top of the Live Mesh platform. And the Live Mesh platform is, as you think about it, the consumer end of this cloud platform that I'm talking about here. So I can't talk much more about the Live Mesh platform at this stage, but if you have a look at the Professional Developers Conference website, you'll notice that there's these 8 sessions here on Live Mesh. And these really give you an idea that Live Mesh is more than the sample app that I'm about to show you. It's actually a broader platform that you'll be able to leverage as developers to write services for tomorrow to run via the web or cross-platform down on the client, whether it's a Mac operating system or a Windows operating system or Windows mobile device. So, coming back onto that one, let's just have a look at an example of Live Mesh, the consumer experience. So when you go to mesh.com, you can install an application, and this is the application here, the blue glowing orb. And it's about really connecting a lot of your different machines, because a lot of people have more than one computer that's connected to the internet that they want to be able to access data from, share files between, and contact information, and remotely access the machines themselves. So with Live Mesh, you can do that. If you open this up here, you'll notice that I have a few computers available to me. This is my computer at home. Oops. That I'm able to connect to if I wanted to connect there. This is my live desktop, so this is actually 10 gig of storage on the internet that I can actually put my files off onto, and this one up here is the machine that I'm working on right now. So if I was to create a new folder, for example, and I call this folder share, and then inside of this folder, if I just grab a image, so grab a picture for example, it's just a photo, I've now got a folder with an image in it. The other thing about Live Mesh is actually not just sharing to your own set of computers, is actually sharing that with others as well. So when I create my Live Mesh folder, right as I did there, right click and add to my mesh, by default it's going to say, you know, what are the folders that I wanted to synchronize this with. So for example, I can say, well, synchronize it, don't synchronize it with my computer at home, but synchronize it with this folder and with the experience out on the internet. So if I go OK now, it's going to create that and replicate that folder up into the internet view as well. And if I click on to this view here, now when I click inside the folder, you'll actually notice that this has got a little area on the right that opens up and shows more detail. And if I click on the members area here and choose to add, I now have the opportunity to type anybody's email address and invite them to be a member of this folder here. So now it's actually going to invite somebody else at this email to be a member to this folder. So the opportunity is that I'm able to now share directly the content of this folder. It could be hundreds of meg, could be a gigabyte worth of files, with another person who is outside of my device mesh. And as they add files or remove files, it will also synchronize those changes back to me. So if you think about this as a platform to build against, the synchronization aspects, the peer-to-peer sharing, the distribution from the web interface, this is all stuff that you can program against for your own applications as well. So that's the share part. And one thing I forgot to mention is that the folders, once they're shared, show up as this blue color so that you know they're part of the mesh. And if I bring up my browser and have a look at mesh.com, what you'll see is that folder is also replicated up into my live desktop as well. So just wait a moment and that will come through. Well, I'll show you that one later actually. Okay, the next thing I wanted to talk about was, how do you architect these sort of solutions when you're building an application out from scratch? So this is actually a demo of an application that was shown at the TED keynote with Bill Gates. And I'll just link to this demo after this video as well. But what you'll see here is there's a few approaches to creating this application. And they're all leveraging the SQL Server Data Services, which is the cloud-based data storage that I was talking about before. You'll notice that there's a Windows client application that uses SQL Server 2008, which ships with the Microsoft Sync framework, and Visual Studio 2008. And then there's a similar mobile application, which also uses a compact version of SQL Server and the Sync framework as well. And then there's a web application that's always connected that uses Silverlight and runs inside of the browser, but extends to the same SQL Server Data Service backend. So you see examples of applications here which are architected using different scenarios, but could potentially all look the same and work against the same data source. whether it's Silverlight in the web app, or then, with Silverlight 2, there's very little change to actually turn that into a WPF 3.5 SP1 application. So these things are almost, almost corresponding to each other as well. And then the other one that I wanted to mention is the syndicated client experience starter kit. Now this starter kit leverages .NET 3.5 SP1. It also uses the Sync framework and SQL Server Compact Edition. So if you go and take a look at the starter kit and download it, it's a beta at the moment. There's a sample app coming shortly that will then show you how to build a photo sharing site that connects to Flickr that creates this client experience. If you wanted to have a look at an example that this client starter kit was based on, it's the New York Times reader that released a couple of years ago. So I'll just show you an example of that. So here is the New York Times reader. And if I just double click on it, you'll notice it was running down here as an application on my machine. First thing you notice with it is that it's synced at some point in time. So it was synced at 9 o'clock this morning. You can see up here that I've got today's paper inside of my cache. I've also got Friday's paper, Wednesday, Tuesday, Monday. I didn't read it on Thursday or Saturday. And if I wanted to, I can actually click through the different sections and read this a little bit like a newspaper. So if I click in the world section here, you'll notice the content moves over quite nicely. If I change the size of the window, the content will scale accordingly to the size of the area that I'm working with. And if I select a different area, say the technology, I could actually click onto one of these items and change the size of the text. It's this item here about YouTube offering TV for TV programs. And I could change the size of the text to actually have it sit with my screen resolution or reading area. And if I select some text here, it's not going to assume that the person who's receiving this or I want to share information with is actually is using the same reader as I am. So if I select this text here and click the email button, what will happen is it's going to construct an email for me, highlighting the text that I've chosen. But it's actually going to link to a page on the New York Times website where you can find this article. And if you type your comment down here, it could share that content as well. Now this is WPF, and this is really what we were talking about with a syndicated client. There is a Silverlight 2 version of this application as well that runs on top of a Macintosh system, which shows, which isn't quite as feature rich as the New York Times reader, but it just shows that you can take a large portion of the WPF application and extend it and run it over as a Silverlight app as well. And if I had to do a search here, I could say search for technology and see a relevance view down here, and then I could see a topic explorer. And if I wanted to actually break out on any of these stories, I could actually see, these are the actual stories that are related and find the information that's contained within them. So it's quite nice to navigate as well. But it's a good example of something that pulls from a internet-based data source and then actually delivers that down to a client which may or may not be online. So that's the Syndicated Clients Experience Starter Kit. So not wanting to scare you in these troubled economic times, one thing I have been noticing is a lot of businesses that are not reinventing themselves online are actually going out of business and shutting down. Now I shot this photo up the road from me at Bond Street on corner of New North Road in Auckland of another United Video store that's shut down and is up for lease. And I'm not sure if you saw just last week, Sky TV, they owned a DVD Unlimited, DVD delivery company here in New Zealand. They bought both of the other two DVD Unlimited DVD delivery companies, Movie Shack and Faxo, so that they now own the complete market for DVD deliveries. Now, I see DVD deliveries as a bit of a stopgap in technology, but it's interesting that they've come in and played aggressively in that area. The other area that's competing is iTunes here in New Zealand. They're now selling and distributing movies directly via the iTunes store to customers who are willing to pay. So it's about looking forward. It's about looking at where your business opportunities are today, but also where they will be tomorrow. So what I did here was I've got some friends who run a manufacturing jewellery business in Auckland called 76 Design, and their business is really about getting customers in the door and making jewellery for them, getting spreading via word of mouth and advertising, and actually pulling in new users. So what I did was I had a look at their existing website, and I had a look at a way that we could actually work with them to maybe use some of the emerging and future Microsoft service technologies to create a new experience for their site. So the first thing I wanted to show you was their existing website. And if you have a look at this page here, which is about your design, it's very simple to see that there's the basic steps of coming in and seeing in the store, showing a mountain of possibilities, and then designing and making a new ring. If you have a look over here at our people, it's around getting an emotional connection with the people who work at 76 Design and learning a little bit more about the individuals who you're going to be engaged with and spending your money with as well. You'll notice over here there's a contacts page which links to an email form where you can ask questions about particular things you're interested in. And over here as well there's a frequently asked questions section where you can learn more about what's going on in the particular rings. There is an extra section over here which has kind of the old school web way of saying under construction. You know, there's nothing here yet, but there will be something here in the future, so come back and take a look. And then over here is a gallery where it shows a sample of the rings that are made from 76 Design. And if you click on one of these images here, you'll actually get a pop-up as well, which displays a bit more information about this ring. And you click and see, and you can inquire about further details in relation to this one. So the first thing I did when I was having a look at this was I thought about a technology we have at Microsoft called Silverlight that's coming up to release shortly. And contained within Silverlight is the ability not only to display photos on the internet, but to take very high resolution versions of photographs and put those up there on the internet as opposed to scaled down versions of the same thing. And this technology is called Deep Zoom. And what you can do when you can create these things is you can upload them to the internet and store them on us at Microsoft and then embed the result back down into your web page. So if we have a look at this example here, this is no longer, as we saw before, just low resolution photographs. It's actually high resolution images. And I can zoom in here as a user and I can look at the details inside this ring, or I could actually zoom down and have a look at this other ring, the other version of the same thing. And more than that, I can hide additional information. So if somebody is interested or accessing the website, they may actually just come over here and have a look at the whole picture as a whole. But then down here, you'll see that I've zoomed in. I've actually put a bunch more photographs in relation to the store and engaging with customers. And down here is actually a view of people who have come and had their rings made and said thank you, and the connection to actually the next process of making the rings. So all this information is available, but it's up to the user or the consumer of the site to come along and learn a little bit more. This is the sizing tool here for checking what ring size you are. And the next challenge that we have is a question of how we can collect that information. So if you think about a traditional model, a traditional model is very difficult to share large amounts of data. So email has its restrictions on what you can share. So a challenge of gathering a very large amount of high-resolution photographs would traditionally be solved by taking them and putting them onto a DVD and currying them out to the person who's wanting to work with them. But as we were talking about earlier in the right-click event, there's actually a growing number of computers and devices that are connecting themselves to the internet. And these devices, more often than not, people have more than one computer, two or three computers that they have access to. And they want to share information between these computers.
and they want to be able to do it directly, and they want to share information with other people who may have be suppliers or customers or accessing the large amounts of information. So we have a technology at Microsoft, which is in technology preview, called mesh.com. And if you go to mesh.com, you can install a little application, which I'll just take a look at here. And this application is a little glowing blue area that sits down in my system tray. I know it's behind the video of me, so you can't see that right now. But what you can do is you can take any folder you like, and you'll notice that this folder here is actually glowing blue, and that's because I've added it to my mesh. And then what I can do is I can share these high-resolution photographs with other people. So for example, to get the photographs from the photographer who took them originally, you could actually put their email address in here and press OK, and then that would share those photographs with that person. And if they added new files or new photographs, they would then synchronize and appear back on your machine. And better than that, we also give you the ability to copy that data up onto the internet as well and have it accessible through your web browser. So if I refresh on this page here, you see I've got a folder with all those high resolution photographs that we were seeing before, and I can access this via my internet browser anywhere in the world or through an internet cafe. So this is 10 gig of storage that we give you by default, and you can use that as a way of sharing files or pushing files out onto the internet source. Okay, the next thing I wanted to talk about was what happens when you click to ask questions via the email form. When I was talking to Angela at 76 Design, she actually spends a reasonable amount of the day on her computer inside the store, referring to customer emails and also doing accounts and following up with quotes and these sort of things. And quite often, she may be running an instant messenger program like Microsoft Live Messenger. And in the case if that she's actually doing that, what we're able to do is we can detect if somebody comes in and clicks a contact button, and then using like a lightbox effect like this, we can say, well, Angela's actually online with Instant Messenger, so instead of using email, let's actually connect directly and start a conversation with her. And you'll notice here it's already got the fact that I'm logged in because I'm a Hotmail user and I do use a bunch of Microsoft services, but I could come in as an anonymous user if I wasn't already had a login for a live ID. And now when I click OK, I can actually start to communicate by the web form here, and we'll notice what happens is this message gets sent along and then comes up using the Live Messenger application that Angela is running on her machine. And because I'm logged in, I've already got context of what I said last time I was communicating. So I can already, even though this customer is not necessarily a colleague of mine or I know who they are, I'm able to remember what I said and to continue the conversation. So I can type in here, how are you going? And what will happen is that information will then be sent back via the internet and then appear inside the person's internet browser in the form that they're working with here. So the key thing is, if you're adopting this sort of technology, that you have to think about being there or only displaying this window when you're prepared to respond to the inquiry. Because there's nothing worse than actually delivering a form like this and having the requests go nowhere. But if you do have salespeople or people responding to these customer queries and you've got them set up to use Instant Messenger, it's just another way of directly connecting and communicating with your customers. Now the next thing you'll notice on the side is there's a click here for a map. And when I click that, I'm not quite sure, it opens two windows. But one of the windows here is just a static image of the area where the store is located and a photo and a little drop point that shows this. Now an alternative to this is to use Microsoft Virtual Earth. And if I click the map here, again we'll see the lightbox effect of the location appearing where the store is located. And in this case, I get an aerial view of the map with a custom pushpin, which is this pushpin here, which shows the location of the store. And the advantage of this is if I scroll out, I can actually have a look around the local area within the vicinity of where the store is located. And I could see a landmark over here, like the Auckland Museum. And I could identify that the, you know, where the store is in relation to the museum. I could flick over and have a look at a road view instead of looking at the aerial view that we had before. And I could get driving instructions or maybe instructions on how to get from my location to the store's location. And even if I wanted to, I could flick over into a 3D view as well and have a look at this same map over in a 3D environment where I can navigate in and look at the store's location and look at it in relation to the elevation of the mountains and the domain and the areas around it. So this is just another way of interacting and looking at the data that we've got here. And it's very easy by plugging in the control that we have already working for us. Now, the next thing that I've noticed is very often small business websites get created, but the content isn't updated very often. So these days, a lot of people are walking around with phones in their pockets, like this one I've got here. And what they're able to do is these phones have video and camera capabilities as well. So if I unlock my device here, what I could do is actually take a photograph using the camera that I've got. And you could think about this as if you're a small business that's attending a trade show or looking at those sort of locations and wanting to share some information about where you physically are. So I've just taken a photograph out the window here. And you'll notice that that photograph is turned up onto my phone. And I can click on this photograph and send this to some sort of online photo sharing service. So in this case, I'm using Live Spaces, but you could use anything that your phone provider accepts or works with. And now that's sending that up to the service, I could actually come over to this page and see the service where the photo will be located shortly. And then I could take the outcome from this and embed this back down into my own website. So it just becomes part of what I'm displaying to my customers. So I can continually update. You could do this with blogs or written word or other things like that, but it's a great way of keeping up to date with the content that you're sharing online. And the same thing applies to video. This is a video here of Sean taken inside of 76 Design. You notice I can play this video. I can stream it full screen, so I can go full screen across the internet. You'll notice over here that I've actually put a watermark in to brand it so that it's tied in with the company logo. And it's a great way of actually connecting with customers. And this was very easy to do because I walked into the store again with just a portable camera here and shot the video and then uploaded it using the Silverlight streaming service that we have here and embedded it back into the page. So at the end of my session, I've got some links where you can actually find out how to do this that process as well. And now it looks like that photo's finished uploading. So if I refresh on this page, what we should see is a sixth photograph appear, which is the one that I've just taken with my phone. It's a little slow. I've got a slow connection here. So while that's loading, the next thing I was thinking about was what was the other area of the site? And it was the extras area which was under construction. And this is a great space to think about taking what was considering future technology or emerging technology to put in there to engage customers and have them see something that they haven't seen before. So at Microsoft, we've got a technology called Photosynth. And Photosynth has recently come out of our research labs. And what it is it's the ability to take lots of photographs and stitch them together into a 3D model. So what I did was I walked into 76 Design, again with my digital camera here, and I took 220 photographs just around the front of the store. And then using the Photosynth tool that I've got, I added them to the client and I uploaded it to our service and then embedded the result down in the web page into that extras area of the site. So if I come over here and take a look at what that looks like, this is an example of a 3D view from the store. I can hide the photographs and I can actually navigate around the scene a little bit. And if I zoom in here, you'll notice that Sean actually has two heads because he didn't stay still during the time that I shot the photos. But I could zoom in, I can have a look at the details inside of Sean's shirt, and I can just wait a moment for my internet connection to actually sharpen up that image. I can look at all the photographs that were taken to make up the set. And if I click on a particular image here, I can then actually zoom in and zoom right in and have a look at the jewels sitting on top of the teacup in very high detail. And I can zoom out and have a look at the jewels down here at the bottom. And I can start to actually navigate around the store, including things like clicking on the cabinet over here and have a looking inside of the display case and looking inside of the area here and looking at the jewels that and the displays that are there as they come into effect, and we can see them in really sharp detail. Now the other thing is there's paintings on the wall here inside of the store, and I can really get in close and actually look at the details inside the painting as well. And if I come out of here and I come out a few steps, you'll notice that there's a table down here. And if I look on the table, I'll see that there's a book on the table. And included in Photosynth is another tool called HaloSynth. And what this is intended for is if you actually take photographs around an object, it will model that object in a 3D space. And if I zoom in here, I can really see the details on the front of the book that I can learn more and have a look at the existing designs that 76 Design has put together. So this is all readily available using the Photosynth tool, but it really delivers via the internet connection an amazing experience for customers who aren't able to visit the physical store, who want to learn more about what you do and actually feel like they're entering and engaging with you directly. So that's the Photosynth technology. And this is a company in Germany who traditionally sold fashion via a mail order catalog. And this time we're not using a website, we're actually using a Windows application that's been built using Microsoft.net. And this application works offline, so it works when people are not connected to the internet in slow connection areas. But it does look for an internet connection, and then it also downloads new content from the catalog when new content is available. And if I hover my mouse over here, it navigates through the catalog. I'll see any items I like, I can click on them. If I click on the lady over here, I'll see all the items that are associated with this particular outfit. If I click on the video here, I can actually see a video of this outfit being modeled, so I can get a feeling for what it's going to look like. I can flick this over and choose my size and choose color and things like that and purchase the item. Or I can flick this back and I can actually have a look at it using like a fashion TV. So over here, if I click it out here, I can now be streamed video content and really feel like I'm at a fashion show being sold this content and this idea. So we'll just wait a moment for that video to stream in. And you can see the video and streaming through there. And it can play out some audio as well. Which is a really great way of engaging and feeling like that you're part of the experience that's being delivered to you. Now, the next thing I wanted to show here was, what are these clothes actually going to look like on me? So the next problem with buying fashion online is whether the clothes will look good on you or your body shape. So what I've done here is I've uploaded a picture of myself into the tool, and using this little icon down here, I can add items to my wardrobe. And then if I click that item, I can then click here inside the mix and match area. And this is my avatar that I've uploaded to the site. And I can scroll through the items that I've bookmarked and select a particular top. And maybe if I wanted to, I could change it to a different pair of pants. And then I could actually add this item over here into my wardrobe and look and save it for later use. And this is a really exciting way of actually checking things out, looking at them, you know, trying them on, and before you're making the purchase decision. So what we were seeing here, thinking about the first version of the web, you know, what can I find? It's about having a web browser connected on a device, and the problems and limitations have been to do with the development skills that exist at that specific point in time. Next, we think about the social web, and we're thinking about, this is really where we are right now today, and it's about participating
and having access. If you think about what social networking sites you're a member of, whether it's Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn, Bebo, these sort of things, what you're really doing here is you're contributing to the internet and you're providing context and information and you're reaching out and contacting friends and other individuals. The issue here is that we've got a lot of fragmented identities. So we've got a lot of ways of logging into different services and we've got a lot of personas and different personas that we use online. Further to this, I think about the next version of the web. And the next version of the web is all about context. It's all about, what do I need and how do I need it? It's no longer about the computer that we had before. It's more about a lot of devices that are all simultaneously connected to this ubiquitous network that provides us context and also location awareness. Great example was during this tour, we drove from Dunedin up to Christchurch, and as we were driving along, had a mobile phone that not only had a GPS location in it, it was also tracking our traveling distance in real time and mapping that on a map with an aerial view of the location and the roads that we were traveling. So although we'd never been there before, we were getting a lot of information exactly about where we were located and where we needed to go next to get to the next town that we were coming up to. If you think about the next version of the web, it's really about privacy and trust. So the privacy laws that exist in New Zealand right now have not been extended to the online world. And the issue is that you currently think about it as being the physical world and the online world, but in the future, these things will come together and you won't have a choice about how you exist and where you are placed. If you think about RFIDs inside of our passports, we're actually moving in a way that we have to exist online and we have to exist in this new world. So therefore, we need privacy laws and things to come forward to actually bring these things together so that we're not thinking of them as separate entities or separate things. So I showed you in the jeweler's example, an example of using the Silverlight technology. If you think about Silverlight and Silverlight 2, it's very close to release now, and Silverlight 2 is based on a compact version of .NET Framework 3.5. So it's about having the majority of that version of the framework available on a client, cross-platform or future on device, to give you the power of working in those languages that you know and like. But doing it without having the overhead of downloading the entire .NET framework to that machine that's running the app. If you have a look at this example here with Silverlight 2, there's a lot of the data enhancements that we got with .NET 3.5, so Link or Link to SQL. We've got generics and collections, and we have also the capability of working with a lot of different types of web services to communicate. This common language runtime we've got here, this is about .NET and VB.NET as the languages. And then further over there we have extensible application markup language, XAML, which is our interface for building Silverlight 2 and WPF apps in both the Otto and the Jeweler's example. And then down here is the little component that I was talking about when we were zooming in on the rings. So this is the deep zoom component. We've got DRM for our media, and we support out of the box VC1, and we've just announced that we're adding support for H.264 and AAC, which is an advanced audio codec for extending our HD video offerings. So if you think about Blu-ray DVD, it generally comes in three formats: MPEG, which is completely uncompressed, VC1, which we're supporting today inside of Silverlight, and H.264, which we'll be supporting in a upcoming version of the technology. And the other thing down here, the DOM integration piece is very important because it gives you the ability to talk out from Silverlight into JavaScript or HTML and to talk into other plugins like the Flash plugin that you might be working on the page. So for example, if you were doing an application and you had some complex client-side script, you may look at writing it in C#. And running it inside of Silverlight 2, even if it doesn't have a UI, because it's a compiled language and it could potentially run a lot faster than if you were running it inside of JavaScript. So if we look at how the implementation is modeled, we have a web server with our ASP.NET page or HTML page, and we push down HTML and JavaScript to the web browser, and then we actually push down, in addition to that, the XAML, which is the interface for our SQLite app, and the .NET assemblies. And then that's consumed inside of the plugin, which is the Framework 3.5 on the client. And then from the code behind, we can then talk out to services on the web using plain old XML, RSS, JavaScript Object Notation, or SOAP. And on the server, we can have REST services, SOAP services, or RSS services. And from our code behind on the client, we can use isolation storage, which is, I think, about 10 meg. And then on the server, we've got SQL storage that we can leverage as well. So if your application needs to exist or go offline, you can do that using these technologies too. So that's a good wrap-up of Silverlight. Where we are with Silverlight 2 right now is the release candidate is available, and we're very close to the release of the technology. So definitely go and try the release candidate, get your things working, and then when we ship Silverlight 2, we're all released to web, we're going to bring forward all of the Silverlight 1 and Silverlight 2 beta installations very quickly to run on the Silverlight 2 release plugin. So with all this talk, what about the browser? What's happening with the browser? Well, right now we've got IE8 Beta 2 available for you to test, and I really recommend, if you're doing web development, to go and have a look at IE8 Beta 2 and to try it out with your sites. I've been running it as my native browser since I released, and I'm pretty happy with its capabilities right now. So if we look at the browser, the first thing you'll notice with IE8 is that it's got a completely new rendering engine. Now, we got so far with what we could do with the previous engine. It was, I think, 11 years old. It had been used in all of the versions leading up to IE7. But we hit a point where we just couldn't really fix any more of the bugs without a large amount of effort. So what we've done is we've built a brand new rendering engine that's nothing like IE7 or IE6. So as a web developer, what you need to do is you need to treat IE8 as as a complete new engine. On release, it's going to be CSS 2.1 standards compliant with some CSS 3 and HTML5 features. And it's going to work more like modern browsers than like IE6 or previous Internet Explorers. So if we have a look here, this is an example of the Air New Zealand site being rendered by the new IE8 engine. I'm pretty sure they didn't intend this tab to be down here, and I'm also pretty sure that this big white block here is supposed to have some content in it, aside from that big white square. Now, there is another button that appears inside of IE8, which is this compatibility page icon here, and it's showing as a broken page at the moment. And this is because the person who's built the site at Air New Zealand hasn't told the browser what to do with it. So we provide options to actually give the IE8 information on how to render. And if I click this button here, it goes into compatibility view mode. It renders using the IE7 engine, and it looks exactly the way that I think it's intended to be created. It then adds the Air New Zealand site to the compatibility list for the browser, which means next time we go to this site, it's going to render inside of this view. Now, if you are building web apps and you're working with web apps today, I recommend what you do is very quickly you put as a page-wide header, a site-wide header, the emulate IE7 meta tag. And what this will do is it'll hide this little page up here, and it will also tell the browser to actually use the IE7 engine to render the site. And this is a good stopgap to get ready for IE8 before you can actually test and deploy your pages for the IE8 browser. So it's a great way to actually ensure that, you know, people who are adopting this browser early are not getting a broken experience, but you're also keeping in touch with how to move forward. And hopefully by putting this new rendering engine out and by actually making it stands compliant by default, we're reducing the pain or process required to actually cater for IE as a separate browser to, say, Firefox or Safari on Mac. You should be able to treat these things all as the same. The other thing is, what happens once I've actually been to talk to Air New Zealand, which I have, and they start to build their pages and identify IE8 as a separate browser, which they do support, they can then put a tag on top of their page to say emulate IE8. And what that will do is it will remove Air New Zealand from the compatibility list on the client, and it will then hide this button up here as well and start rendering the pages using the IE8 engine that is the default. So that's a good overview of you know, how to cater for and to get ready for the new engine. Once you install IE8 Beta 2, you can go to the site ie8demos.com/try it, and there's a lot of and things that you can try to work with the different enhancements for the browser, including things like instant search and AJAX navigation and tab isolation for other components that are there. The other thing I wanted to show you briefly is that if we come into a page over here, what we're doing now is we're building the DevTools into IE8. So every release of IE8 will have the DevTools, unless of course you remove them by group policy. And if you press F12 here, it'll bring up a DevTools view of this particular site. And as I navigate through, IE8 is no longer the black box it used to be. I could click on an item here and I can see all of the styles, the CSS styles that are applied to that item. I could trace just the styles that apply to this item now. I could change the layout view and I can actually edit this data. So I could say, okay, let's make that 482, and I will actually see that edit change and the page change accordingly as well. And if I come back in, I could save this. I could look at the updated CSS, which will then respond back to the correct location in the CSS file and make those changes back on the server. And you'll notice up here we've got the ability to switch between browser modes, and we've got the ability to switch between document modes to have a look at those changes inside of the profiler as well. And if I was to click on the script, we'll see that there is now you know, insert breakpoint, step in, step out, console.write type functionality that we can work with inside of the dev tool directly from the browser itself. And one more thing I thought I'd show here is, if I do a refresh on this page, this is actually a very popular Mandarin speaking site here in New Zealand. And if I wanted to actually understand it, we've got a concept called accelerators, where I can highlight some text here on the browser, and then, sorry, I'll just highlight the text on the browser, and then I can actually have a look and translate this. And this is where you can write services that you can plug into the browser model that can do things like looking up a phone number, you know, mapping data, all of that sort of stuff, and providing that experience down to your users. So that gives you, you know, a literal translation of the content. And if I was to bring up the DevTools here, the other thing I can do on this site, if I do profiling, I can start a profile and reload this page. And if you've got use cases, and you know, you do use case testing when you're building your apps, and you know, you're checking if things are breaking, one thing you could do is when you deploy your web apps, you could also do profiling. And what this does is it tells you how often your JavaScript runs, you know, the inclusive time, the exclusive time, and you can actually save these reports off. So you could see potentially whether a developer has not only, you know, broken the app, but whether they've added new functionality that slowed down your web page or sped up your web page, and by what proportion. So you can get that sort of information out, again, saving this and, you know, saving this one here and exporting the data to monitor with different reports. So there's some quite useful stuff for web developers in IE8. Definitely download it, install it. We've got virtual images of all of the different versions of IE on all the different operating systems available from linked off the IE blog, and I'll link it off this post as well. So if you do want to, those last for 3 months, and when they expire, you can get another one. So you're already in a position to actually test the different scenarios that have been hard to test previously. So that's IE8. Now, the next thing I wanted to do just before I wrap up this session is we're talking about cloud computing, we're talking about rich internet applications, and we're talking about the web and the new capabilities of the browser. One of the things I wanted to do was just give an overview of the service model that now exists for building APIs and for extending your applications to provide or consume interfaces from other things out in the cloud. So this here, this is a photograph of the internet in 2004. You'll see a lot of nodes. You'll see it really does look like a web. And if you think back to 95, 96, 97, when we first started using the internet, I know I had a 9600 baud modem and used a WinSock to connect, and it was really quite a crappy experience. But the interesting thing was that because of the way that the internet is architected, by being simple and open, it's got its addressing scheme, it uses the HTTP protocol, and it scales best when it's stateless and cached. It was better the second time round, because once the information had been downloaded, I went back in and it was already there. I didn't need to get it again. And so I think that's the reason the internet has evolved, is because people have found it useful, and this resilience, caching, and stateless model has actually made it more interesting and more usable for people who have had slow or low connectivity. But if we think back to about 1998, Microsoft and other vendors, BEA and Java and some organizations, said, well, how do we move from a web of pages to a web of services? And it was at this point that we came up with this guy here, which is SOAP. And we proposed the specification for SOAP to work with the internet to create this this services for mainly inside the data center, applications to talk across and between each other. And what's happened is SOAP has evolved, but it used to stand for Simple Object Access Protocol. It now doesn't stand for anything. It just stands for SOAP because it's not simple. It's not an object access protocol. So where we are with SOAP today is that it kind of ignores the transport that's HTTP because it's been designed to work over lots of different transports, whether it's TCP or X508. It has reliable messaging, it's got secure messaging, and it's really quite powerful in its capabilities of what it can do. But it's not that useful in some other scenarios where you might want to actually have a simpler approach. If you're not using .NET, which supports SOAP services so well, if you're using just JavaScript or PHP or another type of language. So a few years ago, I had some people come up to me and say, well, what's Microsoft doing for REST? And I must admit, I had to say at the time, well, I don't really know what that is. I don't know REST. And when I did a little bit of searching and a little bit of digging, I realized that what REST is it's something that's evolved organically via web developers online who have tried to solve or come up with a solution for how to pass information as services between different websites and different web pages. And the RESTful tenants and the way that REST works is very similar to the way that the web works. The web of services should work the way that the web of pages works. It should be simple and open. The universal API should be HTTP. It should just work on that transport. We should have linked resources. So services should link the same way that hyperlinks work. Take an example, if you go to boeing.com/aircraft/747/book, that would be a way of booking a seat on a 747. And they're also stateless, and they scale best when cached and leveraging the proxy servers and the HTTP infrastructure that's out there today that makes the web scale so well. So these are the RESTful tenants. But what's interesting is that because rest doesn't have a specification, there is such a thing as the rest continuum. So you think about soap. People don't say, well, that service isn't very soapful, because it's either soap or it's not, because it's got a specification of how to make a soap service. Whereas with rest, there's a group of people out there who, let's call the pragmatists, who say, number eight wire, as long as it works, it's fine. And this is considered low rest. And some of the things are that all the services could post to the same URL. We could use query strings to identify the different data, and just use get and post as the HTTP verbs. Get for fetching and post overloaded for pushing data down the line. And this works fine from AJAX and plain old XML. So this is a great way of lowest barrier to entry, simplest services that you can use to transfer data around. And then there's another group who are the purists, and these people are like accountants. You can think of them with having well-constructed URIs, using all of the verbs get, post, delete, and put, and then also having standard representation, like I said before, with URLs that can be rewritten to make sense based on the service that is being passed through. Now, Microsoft's position on all of this is that SOAP is great. It works really well for reliable messaging. We've got a lot of framework support in there with .NET services, ASP.NET. But REST is also great. And we're starting to support with .NET 3.5 both low REST and high REST solutions. So we've got new components inside of the framework that enable that. And really, you can now go and use WCF to build either solutions, either SOAP or REST solutions, and go in peace. So I've got some blog posts at the end of this, sorry, some links at the end of this video for some blog posts and some videos on using WCF with REST inside of .NET 3.5. But thinking forward with this cloud platform with rich internet apps, and there will be some scenarios where you need to look at building your own REST APIs or consuming REST APIs as well. So come the PDC, which is in a few weeks' time, definitely have a look at what we're doing with WCF and REST there too, because I think you'll be pleasantly surprised with some of the enhancements. So thank you very much, and I did want to leave you with one quote here, that every generation imagines itself to be more intelligent than the one that went before it, and wiser than the one that comes after it. In the 3.5 years that I've been in Microsoft, I really enjoyed the way that the company has evolved, and we've built our services based on feedback and things that people are using out there in the real world. REST support is just one example of this, but as is the interfaces for cloud computing and other areas like that. So stay tuned, and definitely can look at the material that's presented at the PDC. And this is the blog post where you probably are looking at this video from, that I'm going to serve a lot of the links and a lot of the samples, and you can try a lot of these things for yourself. So thank you very much.